This is the continuing oral history interview of Bernice Mosifer Rind. This is the second mini-disc tape continuing the interview. So we left off with you talking about the teacher who came to your home and brought an Irish harp.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And so I started harp lessons with her. And her name was Edith Knapp Lundgren. She used to come from Tacoma to teach.
Can you spell her name?
Lundgren, L-U-N-D-G-R-E-N. She died just a few years ago, seven, 8 years ago, something like that. I studied with her, and then when she would go on a vacation or whatever, I would have Mr. Graff, who was with the symphony.
Can you spell his name?
G-R-A-F. He was very brusque. He used to scare me to death. Very strict, and he was a very good teacher, but he scared me. I was, you know, just a little child. And then I started giving recitals when I was 8, and I continued straight weight until I was 23. And I was tired of giving concerts and recitals. I wanted to get married and have a family, and so I went into semi-retirement.
I want to talk a little bit before your retirement, because this is a very significant part of a child's life to be so dedicated to an instrument. What was that like at starting to, were you touring outside of the Washington State at 8 years old at that point? Where were you going?
The first few years was basically within the state. And then as I got older, and my mother could leave the two boys with my dad, then we'd go down the coast.
What kind of music were you playing?
Classical, all classical. And then my own compositions, too. When I was 11, I made my debut with the symphony in Los Angeles. And James Sample, who was a young man at the time, was the conductor. He was very nice to me, very nice. And we lived in Los Angeles for a short time. My mother took me down during the summers to study and sometimes to give concerts. And there was a Lyon and Healy. Lyon and Healy is the name of a harp manufacturing company. And they had a magnificent store there. And so I would go down and practice there. And I remember they brought in a new harp, and it was for a Harpo Marx. And they let me play it. So whenever I went there, I could practice on Harpo Marx's harp before he even got a hold of it. So I was really quite thrilled about that. It was a beautiful harp. And then I was practicing one day, and a young man comes in. He was in an orchestra, a violinist. And he asked if I could go out on a date. And I said, oh, no, I can't. I said, I'm only 11 years old. I can't go out on a date. Told my mother. My mother says, it's not that you're 11 years old. I said, he's a Gentile. You can't go out with a Gentile. At the time, that was the major thing. It wasn't your age so much. It was whether you were Jewish or not. But at any rate, I of course, he would just come and listen, and we would talk about music, and it went that way. And I don't know how old he was, but he probably wasn't very old, but I thought he was. Maybe he was 18, 19, something like that, I suppose. But at any rate, that was when my recollections of playing on Harpo Marx's harp.
What's the life of a child? Did they call you a prodigy in those days because you were so young?
Yes. A child prodigy, a harp virtuoso.
What's the life of a child virtuoso like?
Well, you don't really know anything other than that you go to school, and then you practice, and then you prepare, and you don't really have any companionship because it's just musicians, and it's usually older people. I didn't until I went to college when I was 15, I didn't know any slang expressions because I was always talking to adults. I didn't know, well, there was a lot of things I didn't know. I didn't even know you had sororities. I didn't know that that there were Jewish sororities or what they were for or anything else, because that had nothing to do with me.
How did you feel about your harp playing? What was the experience of it like for you, both on and off stage?
Well, I was a nervous wreck most of the time preparing, but once I got on stage, I was fine. But before each one, I was nervous. I couldn't eat. But then you'll find that most musicians are that way. They can't eat before a recital or a concert. They eat afterwards because it's a relief to get it over with, and you can relax. And I didn't know any differently, you see, so I can't really tell you what it's like. But I do recall, as I got older, when I was in my late teens and early 20s, I was taunted quite a bit by some of the young people down in San Francisco, or Palo Alto is a bit particularly, and here in Seattle, about, for instance, they'd say, well, I'm not going to have a career like you when I grow up. I'm gonna have a husband and children. And I didn't say anything, but it always hurt to have them say that to me. They made me feel outside the human circle, which I was basically outside their circle. But I was a human being, you know, and I wanted things too when I grew up. But so just as probably today some of the feminists will pick on some of the stay-at-home moms, well, I was picked on in the opposite way in those days. And it was a bitter experience for a young person. At least I never said anything to anybody. I never complained to my mother because I figured she had enough to contend with without having me tell her anything. I just grinned and bore it, shall we say.
Were there any stories that you remember from particular performances, things that happened or the way that people responded to you? You know, you think about Midori Ito and all these young child prodigies. At least in my lifetime, that's become quite the thing to have a young person kind of headline a symphony. I'm wondering if there were particular things that happened to you or stories that you remember.
Yes. When I was 11 or 12, they wanted me to be in the movies. They always wanted child stars. And I thought, well, my mother said, well, it's up to her. She has to decide. I won't make that decision because it's her life, which I always appreciated very much. And I said, no, I want to go back to Seattle. And then I realized also that my mother and I were living in California, but my mother, my dad and my two brothers were up here in Seattle. And I didn't want to split the family up. There wasn't anything in the world that was worth doing that for. And I said, I want to go back to Seattle. I want to graduate from school. I want to go to Sunday school. I want to go home.
How old were you at this point?
11, 12 years old. Then was when I was about 17. I was asked to be in the movies again. My brother was telling me something the other day, which I recalled. He said we were at Griffith's Park in Los Angeles, which is a beautiful park, and we had taken our dog there. Well, now I was more than 17. I was about 19. Yeah. And he says, and this fellow was in his car, and he parked his car and came out, and he was talking to my brother, and he said, who is that girl? And he said, that's my sister. He said, she should be in the movies. She's a beautiful girl. And so my brother said, you know who that was? And I said, no, that was Robert Taylor. He said, oh. he was my idol at those days, you know. And which I remember the man, but I don't remember that it was he. He had been on a shooting thing with Clark Gable. They used to go hunting, and so he had a beard, because he had to go home and clean up. He'd been away the weekend, and I said I didn't remember that. I didn't know that. I remember being in Griffith Park. I remember the man in a car, but I don't remember who it was. They told me another time when we were in, it's still Los Angeles, but practically Westwood or something like that. And this woman walked by with this man whose name I can't remember, and she said, "Look at that girl. She should be in the movies." It was Jean Tierney. Now, these are names that are unfamiliar to you.
I never Jean Tierney.
But she was a beautiful woman. I don't think she's living.
But it sounds like these were more about being in a particular place, because they didn't necessarily see you playing the harp.
No, they were just interested in my face.
What do you think about that? Looking back at pictures of yourself.
About being in the movies?
Yeah.
Well, I was always very flattered. But see, I never considered myself an actress.
I understand, though, that as a harpist, you did study harp for movies at USC and
yes.
UCLA.
Well, that was just for writing.
When did you start writing compositions for the harp?
Eight.
At 8 years old. Was that something that was encouraged, or it just came out of you?
It just came. Harp music is rather limited repertoire, and I felt that the harp could do so much, and most everything is just so weak sounding, that doesn't show the strength of the instrument, you know, whereas the piano has the percussion, you have your strength in the sound, where in the harp there's just so much depth that you can get in the sound. Because otherwise then you get a very coarse sound on the sounding board if you pull too hard. And so I started playing music that I thought was flattering to the instrument and unique to it.
Do you remember the name of your first composition?
Mm-hmm. Catena di Trelli. And it means a chain of little turtles.
Why did you name it that?
I just got it out of the music dictionary. I wanted to call it something different, you know, and I liked the sound of it. I knew what it meant.
Were you able to perform that piece?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wrote it down in a very childish script of music, and that, you know, it was just a little child's piece, you know.
In terms of other recordings, I know in 40 or 41, right around the time you retired at the age of 23, you recorded another composition of your own. Was that Rhapsody in F minor?
Yeah, that was, that was in the 50s, yeah.
Can you tell me about that piece?
It's a rhapsody. Is very demanding of a harp. It brings out a lot of the harp that people don't really hear, because usually if you know when you go to to a symphony when you hear the harp, it's just small portions and it's usually a little tinkle-like sort of thing. Or a glissando, you know, and this is more demanding in the bass and some strength in the body of the music, and it's also very oriental, Asia Minor oriental, so it's very close to my heritage.
Let's explore that a little bit. Where did that come from? When did you write the piece initially?
I was about 13 when I wrote it. And then I wrote it for my mother for Mother's Day. And then it was published when I was 17. And it won me some awards.
What do you think about that piece now?
It's one of my favorites. Yeah, I know it is. It's not a real mature piece. It takes time and years to be a mature composer or musician or writer or anything. But for the time and for my age, it was good.
Now you said that you wrote it for your mother, for Mother's Day.
Mm-hmm.
What did she do when she heard it?
Oh, she adored it. She cried.
How do you think upon that now, thinking about that moment that you wrote her this piece that you eventually recorded? Does that have any particular resonance for you?
Well, it's kind of special because of the memory. We were very close, more than just ordinary mother and daughter, because she was my manager, my impresario, if you want. And she worked very hard at it, besides trying to raise a family, too, and she was involved in the community, so that it was very time-consuming. And she was very protective of me. And I remember when I was growing up, and she would tell me, when I was 11, 12 years old, she says, you have to do a lot of practicing now, because pretty soon, because of your age, you're going to be interested in boys, you're going to be interested in growing up, and you're going to feel differently, your body's going to be developing, so that you have to devote all your time right, pardon me. And she was very wise, as I said. So.
That's pretty incredible.
Yes.
It's pretty incredible.
She was, as I say, she was very bright. She had an IQ of 172, so you can see she was very bright. People say, oh, you're just like your mother. I'm not even half like her. I haven't got her brain. I wished I did, but I just don't have it. She was so much brighter than I.
How did you see that? How did you see her special talents?
Well, I wish that she'd had the opportunities that I had. Had she had the money, that she could have had someone take care of her children and gone to the university, and she would have achieved great things. She was so bright. And she had a phenomenal memory also, great retention, tremendous. My dad did too. It runs in the family, great memories. I don't know about my generation, but my parents and my grandparents had marvelous memories. But I'm
curious, as a woman, as a very young woman, how did you relate to the harp in terms of being a female? Was it considered an instrument for women, or particular for men? Is the harp a gendered instrument?
Not really. It just happened that there were very few harpists in Seattle. Very few. Basically because of the cost of the instrument. And perhaps the lessons, but they weren't any different than piano, I'm sure. But there were more women studying harp at the time than men. And there was only one male harp teacher, but there were several female harpists, harp teachers. And today, I don't know that I would say it's 50-50, but there's more of a balance than there was years ago. There's a great number of male harpists. Some of the best harpists I knew in California at the studios were males. several of them were quite good friends of mine.
Is there any folklore around the harp or stories?
Well, there's an interesting point of the Irish harp, or the small harp, the non-pedal harp, or a lap harp, which is also similar to what the Irish play. And that is their very old instrument. And there's a great number of people in Ireland that play it as part of, they have a harp in their home like we have pianos in our home. And they play the small lap harp, and they're called harpers. And a concert harp, or a standard size harp with pedals, a person is called a harpist, male or female. But a harper is one who plays a small Irish harp, or the lap harp. And today there are a lot of companies that have started up making harps. Now, whether or not they're any good, I don't know. I've never tried them or played them. Heard them, they don't sound too badly, but they're not standard harp size.
The fact that in the composition, the Rhapsody composition, you brought in, I don't know, would you call them modal scales, or that you considered more oriental, mm-hmm. part of your own heritage, was that something that other people recognized? Was that unusual?
My teacher used to say, she said, you play, your music is as if you're reincarnated. That's the way it affected her, which I thought was rather strange. So I thought, well, it's legitimate as a Sephardic Jew.
Did it bring you into the synagogue?
No.
Was it very separate, the two?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Why so?
Well, I don't know. I know I would play for different occasions for the Jewish community, but it was not in a liturgical way. If they had affairs or fundraisers or something like that, then I would play. They would ask me. And I remember they would always offer to pay for transporting my harp or pay me, and my father said, no, I'll take care of it. He was insulted if someone wanted to pay me. And so that, but I never played within a synagogue, except at temple. When my youngest boy was bar mitzvah, I played for him.
What did you play at his bar mitzvah?
What did I play?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I cannot recall.
I'm wondering how, at what point you recognized that you wanted to stop playing at a young age, 23, and what was going on for you?
Well, my mother was very ill, and she wanted to see me married and in a home with a mate before she died. And I knew that she was living on borrowed time for a long time. She had a very enlarged heart, and I remember when I was 17 and took her to the doctor, a heart specialist, and I said, is there anything you can do for my mother? And he said, you take her home, she'll be dead in 6 months. And I just broke out crying. And my mother was sitting on the table with the little hospital gown, you know. And she put her arms around me and she said, darling, don't you worry, I'm going to outlive him. And by sheer determination, she did.
How did she do that?
She was very strong. She just tried very, very hard. And one day my father was very upset. He was working. And someone came by and they said, David, we never see you with a face like that. What's the matter? He said, my wife is dying and the doctors can't do anything for her. And he was just brokenhearted. That was quite a life story, my mother and dad. And so she says, you know, there's a young doctor here who's He's just a general practitioner, but he's just a marvel. So she gave him the name, and my dad called him up, and he came over. And he made certain prescriptions that she should take, and diet, and so on and so forth. And within about a year, she was in better shape. And he took care of her from a number of years, and she died when she was almost 60.
So she died around late 1950s?
57, something like that.
And at what point had you decided to stop professionally playing? What year was that?
I can't remember the year, to tell you the truth.
If you were 23.
Yeah, it was in the 40s, late 40s, early 50s, something like that.
So what was going on for you besides the fact that your mother was ill, and that was a very important part of the decision and her wishes for you?
Well, you see, she always went with me when I gave a recital. I played for her, really. I wanted her opinion. I didn't care what the critics said. I always wanted her opinion. And she would always say, and I, after a recital or a concert, I'd say, "How was that, Mom?" She'd say, "It was good, but you could do better." And so I had to work harder. Then when she couldn't come with me, I just didn't have the heart to play because she wasn't there in the wings for me. She was my incentive, as you know. So it was, I just felt that it was time that I had to level things off a bit. And I mean, I still played, but not to that dimension.
So reflecting back on a career which most people have never had by the age of 23, what would you say were your greatest joys and perhaps dissatisfactions with such an extensive period of your childhood, teenage years devoted to that?
Well, I have no regrets because I didn't know any better. I remember I hear a lot of girls talking about what they did when they were this age or that age, and I have nothing to contribute there because I had a different kind of life. And the only ones that can understand what I was living were young musicians who are experiencing the same thing, or whatever profession they're in. I don't know what else to say.
In terms of earning money, did you feel a sense of your earning power at that age, or did your parents take care of it?
No, there was never much money. No, it was in those days. You just wanted the opportunity to perform. And actually, sometimes it even cost you more by the time you got your harp there or whatever. And so that was it would have been nice, but it just wasn't. It wasn't that thing. The only time that I was offered a lot of money was, I remember I was offered a job when I was 13 on the Bing Crosby's Craft Hour. That's before your time. And they offered me $75 a week. Now that doesn't sound like much today, but you know, the average family, I guess, was only making $12 a week or something like that. Movie stars were only making $200 a week. Shirley Temple was making $250 a week, and she was the biggest thing there. So $75 a week for someone who's not anything big on a program was very, very good. But I'd have to move there, you see. And I said, no, I thought it was marvelous that I'll make all that money, but I couldn't live there. So I remember that, and that was big in those days.
Yeah. Were you part of a union, or were unions part of the dialogue at that point?
Yes. my mother had me join the union here.
What was the name of that union?
76, I think.
The Musicians Union.
And then I remember when I went to Los Angeles, she thought I could transfer, but no. I had to join all over again. Initiation, this, that, and the other thing. You can't work for 6 months in certain work. You can't work with something else for 1 year for residency, you see. And so it was quite different.
Did that cause any problems for you as a working musician?
No, because I was a soloist. So I had nothing to do with that. I was always a soloist. And then when I wasn't in orchestra, I was in the youth orchestra in Los Angeles for a very short time. And that's a privilege to be in. So, I mean, most of us, if we could afford it, we would have paid them to let us in there.
Why was that? What was the youth orchestra like?
The youth orchestra was Peter Marenbloom, who was the...
Can you spell his name for the record?
Marenbloom, Merenbloum, I think, Marenbloum. He was quite the big name in student orchestras at the time, youth orchestras. Yep. He headed the Los Angeles Youth Symphony, and he was very strict, and he was a Jewish man, and he was a very fine conductor. And I was in there for a very short time. It was very difficult for me to get my harp there because my brother was at the university at USC, and he had the car. So he had to rush home from school when he could, get my harp and take it over there for me. Otherwise, I had no way of getting my harp there, you see. So it was the greatest inconvenience is moving that thing. It's very tough to maneuver. It doesn't weigh very much. It only weighs 87 pounds, but it's awkward to move, and it's so fragile and valuable.
What did your harps cost?
My first harp was the little Irish harp. I think that was $75, I think.
Which is about how much today?
Golly, now they're selling for several thousand dollars. Yeah, it's hard to believe. And then my next harp, my mother and dad bought me a student harp. I was 8. I couldn't reach the pedals. I wasn't very big. And I had to sit right on the edge of the chair so that I could reach the pedals to play. And my mother had cashed in an insurance policy to buy the harp because they didn't have the money. That cost $250. It was a used harp, but I was thrilled. And I played on that for many, many years. And then when I was 21, they bought me a concert harp. It was a used harp, and it cost over $2,000 at that time. Today, that harp is $36,000. I was looking up to something yesterday, and I was thinking about that. And that's what they cost. And they cost, and each year they keep going up.
What did the critics say about you when you were playing? Do you remember any particular critics' remarks?
Well, let's see. There was a Franken, can you remember his name? Critic in Los Angeles. Can't think of his name. He was a Jewish man. And he thought that I had great musicality and was very versatile as an instrumentalist. So, which was a great compliment from him because he didn't give many compliments. And Frank,
can footnote it if you remember.
Yeah, I can't remember his name right now.
And I'd like to maybe in the next session maybe explore, because it's in your married life and it, when you had children, that I know that you did play periodically in public. But maybe we can, since you related the end of your career to your mother's illness, and it sounds like there was actually a period of 15 or so years in between, can you talk about the passing of your mother and what that was like for you, since she was so many things to you? What do you remember about that time?
It was very difficult for me. I knew that my father was suffering in silence, but he never said anything. He would just say, I do miss your mother, or she would do this, or she does this, and this, he would. But he never talked about the pain that he felt. They were very close. They loved each other dearly. And I couldn't talk to my brothers because they felt badly enough as it was. We three are very, very close. And so I just, sometimes I thought I would just go crazy. I missed her so much because I would ask her about everything. And then I would envy some of the girls who had their mothers with them, and they would say, oh, my mother just called me up. She's always calling me up. And I thought, my God, how lucky they are that they have their mother. And I couldn't understand how they could talk to them about that. But I guess they had different experiences with their mother, so that it was a different relationship. Both my husband and I were very fortunate in our parents. When they would come over to see us, to see their little grandchildren, you know, as they were being born, they would come and they'd stay 5 minutes and they would go, sit down, stay a while. Though they were so afraid of intruding in our lives, they just wanted to see us and then they would leave. We had marvelous relationships with our in-laws. My mother and dad adored Marty. They loved him dearly, and my mother-in-law always said, she says, you're closer to me than my own daughter, which I thought was a very great compliment.
So. Maybe we can pick up next time with when you met Marty, and we'll continue from there. So thank you for the first part of this interview.
Okay.
This is the continuing oral history interview of Bernice Mossifers Rind. This is Pamela Brown-Lavitt, oral historian for the Jewish Women's Archive Weaving Women's Words Project in Seattle. Today's date is August 10th, year is 2001, and we are at the home of the Rinds. We are continuing this interview with Mini Disc 2. Nice to see you again.
Thank you.
I wanted to start talking about your relationship with your husband, when and where you met, and lead up to your courtship and your decision to get married.
I knew Marty in Sunday school. He and my brother were very good friends. I was in kindergarten at Sunday school, and he and my brother were in the third grade. Of course, nobody ever pays attention to the little brothers and sisters, but I do recall him and his sister, his older sister. There's just the two of them, and I remember that after Sunday school was over, all the kids would be waiting in front of the temple so that the parents could pick them up, and she would kind of look out for the little ones, and I was included in that. And then all through Sunday school I saw him, but I was never interested in him in particular. Then I met him again later on. Was after the war. He and my brother were, as I say, good friends. They hadn't seen each other during the war years. They were in different theaters of the war. And then we started going together, we started dating. He, of course, my dating was that I would have to go with him to exercise his horse. He's an international champion equestrian, champion jumper. And when you have a horse, it's like being an instrumentalist. You have to exercise your horse every day, just as you practice every day. And so that was the beginning of it. And we became engaged about a year later. And then 3-4 months later, we were married.
Where did you go on your dates?
Usually horse shows, things like that. Anything that had to do with horses. If I went to anything that was musical, then I went with, I wasn't engaged at the time, I'd go with some other young fellow who wouldn't invite me. And Marty was never interested in that sort of thing, and plus the fact that he didn't have the time. So he was obligated to his horse. When we were married, we were expecting our first child. We bought a very nice little house on McGilvra and McGilvra Boulevard in Seattle. And then when the baby was about a year old, he couldn't decide if he could afford to keep the horse. So I always teased him that he had to make a decision to either keep me and the baby or the horse. But he wanted the horse to be well cared for, so he gave it to a girl that he used to ride with. And she and her husband have a magnificent farm out in Roy, a small town near Olympia. And so they took Tiny, that was the horse's name, and she took excellent care of him, kept him until he died. He was a fantastic jumper. And he was very big, because Marty's 6'2½", so the horse was 17'2", which is a very big horse. And this horse was so sweet and gentle with my children. Well, we just had the one at the time. But Marty, at 6 months, when the baby was 6 months old, he takes the baby out of my arms and puts him on top of the horse. I about died, thinking that, my God, what's gonna happen, because this horse is accustomed to active people. And he just stood there and just trotted very slowly and carefully. Marty hung on to the baby, and then he took the baby and put it up to the horse's nose, and that was it. And the baby didn't cry. He was accustomed to seeing the animal, because we had dogs in the house, so he's accustomed to animals. And but our first one was never interested in riding. It was my daughter who was interested in riding and having horses.
I want to ask you a question.
Yes.
I know that you had talked briefly in the last segment of the interview about belonging to both Ezra Bezeroth and going to school at Temple to Hirsch. And Marty, is he Sephardic or Ashkenazic?
He's Ashkenazic. Mm-hmm.
Can you describe anything about your expectations with respect to dating either one of you or your families with the Sephardic, Ashkenazic differences
any difference
your backgrounds?
Well, we didn't find any difference at all. We had no problems. You see, his family is from Czechoslovakia, and they didn't associate with Ashkenazim either. They associated with German-speaking people. And when they came to this, well, they first came to this country in 1874, his family, and from to Chicago, and then from Chicago they came to Seattle in the early 1890s. And they associated with people of the same background, of German-speaking Czechs or Austrians, who were mostly Gentiles. They were the only Jews. And they didn't, at that time, nobody went out of their way to associate with the Russian Jews or Polish Jews. Everybody stuck, I assume, stuck to their own little group, and just as the Rins did. And so when when I came along, there was no difference for us because we just thought of ourselves as Americans. And my mother always told me, as I was growing up, because she gave me a very good background on who I was and where we came from and all about our background. But she said, in this country, you're an American Jew. That's number one. She said, but you always have to know who you are and where you came from. And you're a Sephardic Jew. You're a Spanish-speaking Jew, and so that's it. So I grew up with that idea, that knowledge, and I found no difficulty with it, and neither did Marty's family.
Did you have any desire, or in your dating life, were you conscientious or conscious of who was a Sephardic boy versus who was an Ashkenazic boy, and did you date both?
Oh, I knew the difference, yes, and I really didn't know too many Jewish boys. When I went to the university, I was 15, and I didn't know anything about sororities, never heard of them. I just went to the university because I felt I had to have an education. I mean, that's the only thing that I knew about a university. And most of the boys that I met there were non-Jews. And so I went out with non-Jewish boys. If they happened to be Jewish, well, that was fine. And there were a couple of Sephardic boys that I always grew up with from the time I was an infant. So we would date. But there was nothing serious. And I would always tell my mother, I may be dating a non-Jewish boy, but I'm not going to marry a non-Jewish boy. I'll always marry a Jewish boy. It was never my intention to do otherwise.
Where did that value come from that you placed on marriage?
Oh, I think because my mother told me so much about the family background and who we were, and then I felt it was so important for a matter of family survival. I don't know, I just grew up with that idea.
I've heard dating between Sephardim and Ashkenazim referred to in terms of interdating. And I'm wondering, even though you say that you and Marty were fine with it as Americans, how was it received, or how did people respond to it, or what have you heard about it in the community in terms of the way people have responded to dating?
I don't think anybody really thought about it, in particular about us, because they just thought, well, we're a product of Temple de Hirsch. Because that's where we met, that's where we grew up, and we were just a couple of kids from Temple, which I thought was great. I don't think anybody thought of it any other way. They knew I was Sephardic. They knew Marty's family was Czech, Slovakian, Austrian, you know, his background, and that was it.
Did you ever have any experiences where boys who were Ashkenazic would not date you because you were Sephardic?
Oh, no, no. No, a lot of them wanted to take me out. See, there aren't very many blonde, bluish, blue-eyed girls. So, and my mother wouldn't let me date very much because she felt I was too young and inexperienced. Didn't want me. I was very innocent, let's put it that way. And and I was basically a student. So she was very protective of me. And I think that after the boys would meet my mother and meet me, why then they were really very good to me. They took very good care of me. They never tried to take advantage of me in any way. So I was very fortunate.
Since you say you were so innocent, and partly because of your travels, how did you then learn about, you know, sex as a young kid? Did girls talk about it? Were you your parents frank about it?
No, I had no special girlfriends because they weren't interested in the things that I was interested in. And I didn't have time to socialize. You see, I went to school, and then I practiced, and then I gave a concert, and I didn't. There was no time for friendships, and you'll find that in any young artist who's very busy, there is no time for friendships. And in regards to sex, my mother would tell me all about it, and then she would show me medical books and tell me about these things. And then she first told me when I was around 8 or 9 years old, told me about the menstrual period, which didn't seem to enter my brain. But you see, she had first menstruated when she was 9. And then she stopped, and then she started full course when she was 11. So she figured maybe I would take after her. As it happened, I didn't. But then she says, "No, I have everything in this drawer in your room." And I had a sanitary napkin and pads and the whole works there. She told me all about it and what to expect. Well, I'd forgotten all about it. And then we always had a dog, and I remember my little dog was poisoned, and she was hemorrhaging terribly. And my mother was down at my aunt's house, her sister's. Couldn't get the telephone. Somebody was on the telephone, so we couldn't call her. My little brother ran down 3 blocks, ran as fast as he could to tell my mother. He made a special announcement: "Bernice is bleeding. She's dying." You know. Well, I wasn't dying, but then how was I supposed to? I forgot everything she told me, you see. Well, then the next day, everybody in the family knew exactly what happened to me. My cousins would say, "Well, you're a woman now, you know." I about died. Just about died. Never forgot that, you know. And that was my introduction to that particular period of my life.
How old were you?
I was almost 14, and my mother was very concerned. She said, if within the next year you don't have your period, we'll have to go and see a doctor. I am not going to a doctor. Well, anyway, I would have gone if she made me go, of course, but as it was, it was a very natural evolvement of what nature intended. So that was one experience. But I didn't miss any of those things. I was very adult as a young person, because I had no association with girls and boys my age. I was very grown up. I didn't know slang. I didn't learn slang until I went to college, because grown-ups don't talk like that, you know. It's a different speech pattern. It was completely different.
So when you went to the University of Washington at 15, and you mentioned the sororities, was that of interest to you, or did you try to enter?
No. One sorority they'd invited me to lunch a couple of times, but I really wasn't interested. I didn't particularly care for all the paraphernalia they did. And then that was a Jewish sorority. A Gentile sorority, a couple of the girls that were in my music classes that I was very close to wanted me to join that particular sorority, but I felt I really didn't need it, and so I didn't join. A lot of the fraternity boys, Gentile fraternity boys, would ask me out. And I remember in particular, I was invited to a party with this, was a champion, he was from the Olympic team, diver. Can't remember his name. But at any rate, we went to this magnificent house. It was the first time I'd been to a home where they had a butler. And he opened the door, and we entered this gorgeous mansion. And we went downstairs to where all the game rooms were, and so it was a palatial place. And as I say, being kind of naive, I said to somebody, I said to my date, as a matter of fact, "Where is everybody going? Why are they all going into those little rooms?" Well, they were all going to have sex. Well, I didn't know that, you see. I just didn't know what they were doing. I mean, I wouldn't have asked the question if I had known. It took me years later to find out. I was so embarrassed years later, but...
Were Gentile boys faster or more promiscuous than Jewish boys?
No, I don't think so. The one thing I found about the Gentile boys was that they never forced you to do anything. They never forced you to let them touch you or something like that. Whereas the Jewish boys were a little freer. I found that.
What do you think that was?
I don't know. I just maybe because they were young. I have no idea.
So back to you and Marty. Did you somehow kind of have a camaraderie because of your commitments, your great commitments to these activities? Is that something that you really communed about, his equestrian interests and your musical interests? You made the analogy before. Mm-hmm. I didn't know if you could take that any further.
Not really. It was very important to him. It was the only thing. When he got out of the Army, like most of the boys, why, most of their friends weren't around anymore. The kids they'd grown up with or gone to the university. And he did have one particular group of friends that he went to the university with. They went all through Queen Anne and the university, and they went to ROTC and into the Army together. Then they got separated. And I guess he located a few of them, and they have remained close to this day, which I think is remarkable. As a matter of fact, not too many years ago, I ran into somebody that he went to school with, and we were talking. They didn't know that the Rins were Jewish. Nobody looked like, you know, what a person would look like. My mother-in-law looked Scandinavian. She was tall and slim, very lovely, and very low-key people, and just never knew that. And then they thought we were Catholics. We lived in Montlake, and for some reason or other, they thought my father was Irish Catholic. And I don't know where they got that from, but people have very strange ideas that they make up, you know, so.
Is it something about Seattle that people don't wear their religious affiliations on their sleeves?
I think so. It's a small town. Well, it was a small town. It still is a small town. And at that time, Jewish people were very self-conscious about saying that they were Jewish. It was not a welcome piece of knowledge that other people wanted. And as I mentioned before, that it took many years. It wasn't until the State of Israel and the War of Israel and the respect that the nations throughout the world gave the State of Israel that we as Americans have really felt we can say, I am a Jew. And I believe in the State of Israel. I mean, with a certain amount of pride.
I understand that had a particular impact upon you personally. So what do you remember about that time?
Well, it wasn't until being very active in the cultural life of Seattle. I was very active with the symphony, still am, with the University of Washington. And a few other cultural groups in the city. And nobody ever asked me if I was Jewish. And you don't go around announcing what you are. If they knew it, well, that was fine. If they didn't like me because I was Jewish, well, that's their problem, not mine. But one time at a board meeting at the symphony, we were discussing something, some financial difficulties we were having. And I remember I stood up and mentioned that, well, in the Jewish Federation, we do this and this and this. And I said, and I never would have said that at any other time to admit that I am a Jew in front of people, because I felt before that I would have been shunted or asked to leave or just sort of forgotten about, because I was the first person, first woman to be asked to be president, even though I had worked on the committees for a long time. They just, the idea of having a Jew there was something quite abhorrent to them, because it was run by Broadmoor at that time. It was very highly restricted.
What are you talking about? Which organization?
Symphony.
It was run by Broadmoor. What do you mean?
Well, Broadmoor is now not restricted, supposedly. And at that time, no Jews, no blacks. And the same thing with the Highlands, the same thing. At any other neighborhood, you could move in and out, more or less, with certain freedoms. But at that time, that was it. Now, we lived in McGillbrook Boulevard in Madison Park, which is not far from Broadmoor, but that's not, and I wouldn't move into Broadmoor even today if they gave me a house free of charge. They were, the restrictions were dropped when they had, I think it was the liquor license came to a head. And in order to have certain clubs, you had to be free of all restrictions in order to have a liquor license. And so that was that difficult. And I think the first family that ever moved there was Dr. Blue. He is a convert, but very devoted Jew. His wife is not. And then there's the Poles. Mel and Roz Pole moved there. I don't know of any other Jewish family that's there.
Were those restrictions outwardly written, or were they just known by word of mouth?
Common knowledge. Now, when we had to move from where we were, we built our house near Enatai. In Enatai.
Can you spell that?
Enatai. It's near Bozarts, near the East Channel Bridge. And so we were trying to decide where to move or what to do. And my oldest boy was around 9 or 10 years old at the time. And so he says, "Mom, why don't we move to the Highlands? I have a lot of friends there," because he was in the 7th grade at Lakeside. And so I thought, oh, this is going to break my heart. And so I said, "Sit down, Bradley. I said, I have to tell you something. I said, we can go and move to a lot of districts, but we can't move to the Highlands." "Why not, Mom?" I says, "Because they don't allow Jewish people." "Oh," he said, "Mom, but if they know us, they'll like us and they won't mind." I said, "No, darling, it's not that easy. They do not allow Jews in that district, in that enclave." And, you know, it broke my heart to tell my child that. I've never forgotten that. It made me feel very badly.
Does he remember it as well?
I don't know. I don't even talk about it. I don't even know if there are any Jews that live there. But that is another, that was a highly restricted area. There were certain clubs. So for instance, I understand the Seattle Golf Club still doesn't have any Jewish members. And there may be others. The Rainier Club finally broke down and has quite a number of them. And the athletic club was the same thing. But they weren't as bad. I mean, they had a couple token ones at the beginning, but now it's more frequent there. But there are still some areas where it's not a legal restriction, but it's an unwritten law, shall we say. And I don't think that Jewish people would feel comfortable. And besides, we have too much to offer as a people that we have to be asked not to be a part of wherever it is.
I'd like to return in a little bit to your work with the symphony, because mm-hmm. I believe you told me that you were the only Jew.
Yeah, the first, I guess I'm the only Jewish woman who was president at the time, and still the only one. And then one of only two board members for many years. Well, my husband and Sam Levinson were the only two Jewish board members. And then Sam Rubinstein was on. And then I came on. And then there weren't any more, but now it's fine.
So we'll return to your activities mm-hmm. with the symphony in a few minutes. I want to go back to your courtship with Marty, and you skipped through We Got Married and We Had a Child, and I'm just wondering, when did you fall in love? What do you remember about falling in love?
Well, it was no big smash-bang thing, you know. It just sort of evolved, I would say. And it's not like in the movies, as you know, being a young woman with a husband also. It's something that grows even in a very short time that you may know somebody. You sort of have an inkling of what it's going to be in the future. My biggest problem with Marty was that he was so quiet. He still is. I always had to do all the talking, and I was not a talkative person. But I became so over the years because one of us has to do the talking, you know. So that was a big problem. And I guess he expected me to know all these things by osmosis or something, rather. Whereas most of the boys that I would go out with were always telling me all kinds of things about how they felt and how much they loved me or what they loved me, why they loved me and all that sort of thing. And with Marty, if he'd send me flowers, he would just put "Love, Marty." I mean, it was, but I knew that from him, it was very specific and it was very meaningful. And he was just not big on words. Bothered me, but it still bothers me, but that's his nature. But I think what really made me so secure with him was that I never had to fight him off. Sometimes I'd come home and you would think I was through the wars. I mean, and I'm sure you've had the experience with some boys that can't keep their hands off you and you're practically in shreds by the time you get home. And but it was so nice that I knew that I didn't have to go through that with him. So. Because at that time, you didn't sleep with the fellow the first time you went out with him, or the second time, or the third time. You waited until you got married. It was a different psychology, a different world.
When you decided to get married, where did you decide to do it? Which temple and what hall? And tell me about your wedding.
Well, I didn't want to get married at temple. I didn't want to get married as a Basareth because I didn't want to play favorites to either one, and I remember the Olympic Hotel was and their dates were all filled, and so we had it at the Glendale Golf Club. It was out in Burien, and I think we had about 400 at the wedding.
Big wedding.
Well, I must have. I must have had almost 200 just from relatives, you know. So that took up a lot of relatives. And it was a lovely wedding. Marty's relatives came from different parts of the country, and some of mine did too. Most of my relatives live here, so there was no problem that way.
Did you have a rabbi marry you?
Yes, Rabbi Levine.
So it was the rabbi from Temple to Hirsch.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you decide on the rabbi from Temple to Hirsch as opposed to Ezra Bezeroth?
Well, that was Rabbi Kahn. I had wanted Rabbi David de Solopol. I don't know if you know who he is.
Would you spell his name for the record?
David is D-A-V-I-D. De Solopol is D-E, capital S-O-L-A, capital P-O-O-L. He's from a very prominent family. He's deceased now. And probably one of the most prominent Jewish families in the history of not only Sephardic but Ashkenazic Jews. And he used to fly every weekend to France to conduct Shabbat services for the Rothschilds. Well, you see, being young and naive, I didn't know that if I wanted him, well, then my father would have to pay for him to fly into Seattle and pay his expenses and then fly back. Which, of course, my father couldn't afford to do that, but I didn't know that. I just wanted him to do the perform the services. And because I asked him years earlier when I met him, and he said, be happy to. So, but then my father-in-law, Max Rind, asked my father, he said, can we have Rabbi Levine perform the service? Well, my father was so thrilled with Marty and so happy that the Rinds were going to be his mishpacha that he said, yes, anything you want. So that was where I got Rabbi Levine.
Why did you feel strongly about the other rabbi? What is it about
Rabbi
his pedigree and his intellect that you were so impressed by?
Well, I'd read his books. We have several here. I met him in California, but I knew of him when I was a very young girl. My mother had told me about him and about his family. And they have a very long history of very prominent rabbis, professors, and his wife was also a very learned woman. And since he was the best there was, that's who I wanted.
Did you wear a white dress?
It was pearl gray. I had, I have to show it to you. My mother bought me a, kind of stole of pearls and crystals, which was magnificent, handmade for the Empress Eugenie. It was an antique. Ralph Burse had an antique shop on Broadway. At that time, there were a lot of antique shops. And Ralph Burse is Jane Powell's uncle.
How do you spell Burse?
B-U-R-S-E. And he sold this to my mother, and my mother made it into a wedding gown. It's just beautiful. And she had it wrapped in a sheet to keep it protected. And being ignorant, I took it out of the sheet and put it in a plastic bag, which, as you know, is the worst thing you could do. And it changed the color of the gown. So when my daughter got married, I couldn't have her wear it because it was no longer a pearl gray. It was sort of a pink. And I wouldn't have known, I don't know what to do with it, you know. But we chose the pearl gray because of the antiquity of the stole.
Tell me more about that.
Well, it's a magnificent piece. I don't know how the Empress Eugenie wore it. She may have just had it over her shoulders or over her head or something or other. But my mother used it as part of my wedding gown.
Did you feel regal as well?
Oh, yes. Yes, it was beautiful.
What do you remember about the ceremony that you chose? And are there different things that you both pulled from your different backgrounds?
It was a standard wedding that they had in those days, or in these days. Nothing unusual about it.
Did you have an engagement party?
Oh, yes. We had a beautiful engagement party. I'll show you pictures.
Did you do the sort of, we talked earlier in the interview about certain Sephardic customs. Did you have a trousseau?
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Could you talk about that a little?
Well, like most Sephardic girls, or like I assume most of the girls of any place, I suppose, my mother got me all the linens. She gave me all the silver from the family. What else? Didn't miss so many things. When we bought our house, she gave me a little love seat, three oriental rugs.
Did they hang the trousseau?
Yes, she did. She wanted my in-laws to see what she was giving me. And I said, oh, no, we don't want that. Oh, yes, yes, we're going to have that. Oh, no, I don't like that sort of thing.
I was told that the engagement custom of and your embarrassment, there's a word for it. Ashuar?
Ashuar, yes, yes, that's right.
What does that mean?
Ashuar is a trousseau.
It's the same thing.
Yeah.
Is it typical that brides are embarrassed by this? Are they meant to?
Oh, no,